This is Bisbender, and I'm Kayla Stokes. Welcome to the next episode of this podcast, where we are exploring the lives of Black women from the past and the present in order to imagine the future. This week's episode is about the prolific Pauli Murray, and we are joined by State Senator-elect Kim Jackson. Okay. So there's no way I couldn't do at least one episode that focuses on and features a newly elected official. This episode is just that. While this election season has been wild, to say the least, for countless reasons, there have been some aspects that have made me feel pretty optimistic, one of which is the election of a slew of firsts. As you probably saw in the news, there were a bunch of historic elections because of the identity of those elected. I was especially excited to see a lot of Black women among this group of historic firsts. I knew that I wanted to reach out to one of these Black women to see what their journey has been like so far. So, of course, I was thrilled when State Senator-elect Kim Jackson replied to me when I reached out to her. She is going to be the first openly LGBTQ state senator in Georgia when she's sworn in. And she's a Black woman. And she's an Episcopal priest. Needless to say, she is breaking down barriers with her new role. And while she'll be unique amongst her new colleagues, the cool thing about her is that there are plenty of Black women like her who share some, if not all, of her intersectionalities. So I'm thrilled to share my conversation with her, with you all, in this week's episode. But before we dive into that conversation, I wanted to share with you the story of one of her biggest inspirations. When I asked Kim if she wanted me to parallel her story with anyone in particular for this episode, her quick response was Pauli Murray. To be honest, I didn't know a lot about Pauli Murray before I started working on this episode, but I'm so glad that Kim mentioned Pauli because their stories being back to back makes a lot of sense. When asked about Pauli, Kim said the following.
She really is such an inspiration to me. I mean, she was the first Black woman ever ordained as a priest in the Episcopal Church. And I stand in that legacy, right, as a clergy person. But also, I mean, she lived the life in many ways that I'm trying to create, one in which she really worked to change public policy, in which she, as a legal scholar, helped open doors for so many people, and particularly women. And simultaneous to that, she answered a call to serve in ministry as an ordained priest. And so I'm thrilled that you're honoring her and celebrating her work as a just absolutely amazing and such an inspiring person. So I'm glad you're doing that.
For some context before we get started, during Pauli Murray's younger years, she refers to herself with both she and he pronouns, and she expressed how she felt both female and male at different times. However, in her autobiographical work that was published after her death, she uses she/her pronouns to refer to herself. So, while I'm not sure how she would like to be identified today because she is no longer living, I'm going to be using female pronouns because that is how she talked about herself in her later years. But I don't want you to think I am glossing over that part of her identity. So, with that said, let's talk about Reverend Dr. Pauli Murray. Pauli Murray was born on November 20th, 1910. So, the day this podcast comes out is actually her birthday. Happy birthday, Pauli! She was born in Baltimore, Maryland, to her parents Agnes and William Murray. Unfortunately, Pauli and her five siblings had a rough start. Their mother passed away when Pauli was 4 years old. And just a few years later, their father, who suffered from depression, was sent to what was considered treatment at the time in Crownsville State Hospital. During his time there, he was murdered by a white guard. So, Pauli was no stranger to tragedy very early in life. She was sent to live with her maternal aunt and grandparents in Durham, North Carolina. Pauli was also an education fiend. It seems as though she worked hard to understand the world around her, and then from there, she tried to make it a better place. She graduated from her high school in North Carolina with a certificate of distinction. At that point, she moved straight to New York City. She shared the hopes of so many young people. If she could make it to New York, she could find acceptance and something bigger than her hometown. While there, she attended Hunter College and earned her English degree in 1933. This period of her life is the first time we see Polly writing about her struggles with her own personal gender and the concept of gender in general. In fact, this is the point in time when she changed her name to Polly, which helped her feel more comfortable because it sounds more gender neutral than the name she was given at birth. In order to work out how she felt about gender and race and everything in between, Polly wrote a lot. She wrote articles and essays and poems. I mean, she was an English major after all. But her writing ended up taking her far. She had a slew of things published in various magazines, including The Crisis, which was published by the NAACP. I feel like having her work published and circulated must have helped Polly to know that her voice mattered and it should be heard. So she never allowed herself to be complacent when it came to speaking up for what she believed in. When she tried to attend the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill in 1938, she was told no. The universities in North Carolina were all segregated at the time, and UNC Chapel Hill was not interested in making any exceptions. Polly didn't think this was right, so she tried to work with the NAACP to file a lawsuit. The NAACP didn't end up following through with the lawsuit, but that didn't stop Polly from running her own personal campaign about the issue. And it got a lot of national attention, even from the First Lady at the time, Eleanor Roosevelt. So, while Polly didn't end up attending UNC Chapel Hill, she did make some pretty powerful, lifelong friends through the pursuit. And that's not where her efforts for desegregation ended. In the 40s, she began working with the Fellowship of Reconciliation to challenge segregation on public transportation. Phew, that was a ridiculous sentence. In 1940, she was arrested when she refused to give up her seat and go sit in the back of a bus in Richmond, Virginia. And I bet that might sound familiar to you. So 15 years before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat, Polly engaged in the same type of activism. And she knew that she needed more education in order to continue working for the rights of not only Black people, but all the marginalized communities she cared about. So in 1941, she enrolled in law school at Howard University. I've talked about Howard on this podcast before in the Charlotte E. Ray episode, so if you're interested in some context on Howard University's law school, I suggest checking that one out. So Polly graduated top of her class from Howard in 1944. And typically, students at the top of their class were awarded the Rosenwald Fellowship, which allowed them to continue their studies at Harvard University. But even though Polly was awarded this fellowship, she was denied acceptance to Harvard, which is a great example of the term she coined and wrote extensively about, Jane Crow. This term refers to the particular type of discrimination a person faces when they are both Black and female. So, in this case, even though Black men were being admitted to Harvard, Polly was left out, despite her qualifications, because of her gender. Polly pivoted yet again and attended the University of California Bowalt School of Law instead. After graduating, she continued to write and write and write. Among the things she published was a book called States' Laws on Race and Color. As you can tell by the title, Polly was diving right into the good stuff after her law degree. Thurgood Marshall even described the book as being the Bible for civil rights lawyers. I think at this point, Polly had found her place. The 1950s were definitely not easy for Polly. She was a radical thinker for her time, so she was an easy target for the McCarthyism that was running rampant in our country. Much like Jackie Orms from episode 7 of this podcast, ooh, another callback reference, Polly had to deal with the delegitimization that came along with being called out for her progressive views. Luckily, she continued working and publishing despite this. The following decade, she made history yet again when she enrolled in Yale's law school. In 1965, she became the first Black person to receive a JSD from Yale. And she made sure to spend a lot of her time there mentoring young female activists. So at this point, Polly is a full-fledged expert in the civil rights area of the law. And her work was being recognized by the highest office in the government. President John F. Kennedy appointed Polly to the Commission on Civil and Political Rights as a part of his Presidential Commission on the Status of Women. Now, as you can imagine, Polly was the perfect candidate to speak on and investigate what it means not only to be a woman during this time, but also a Black woman, and even deeper than that, a Black queer woman. From the late 60s to the early 70s, Polly served as a faculty member at Brandeis University, where she taught an early American studies program. However, in 1973, her longtime partner Irene Barlow passed away. This life-changing loss helped Polly pivot from her secular pursuits to focus on her religious life. So, not only was Polly an educational powerhouse, but she also spent her life as a churchgoer. She definitely didn't see the need to choose between her identity and her religion. So, at this point in her life, she left her university work and became a candidate for ordination at General Theological Seminary. And, in 1977, Polly was the first woman to be ordained as an Episcopal priest. At this point, I am thinking, what can't this woman do? She spent the final years of her working life serving a parish in Washington, D.C. that focused its efforts on the sick. She continued this work until 1982, when she retired. And, in 1985, Polly passed away from pancreatic cancer at the age of 74. Polly did so much during her lifetime, and I know that I only scratched the surface here, but I want you to know that her work changed our lives. She wrote briefs that were used as the legal basis for changing laws that work against discrimination. I mean, the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg even credited her as co-author on her brief to the Supreme Court when she argued against discrimination on the basis of gender. Polly voiced her struggles with gender and sexuality at a time when that was anything but popular. She published work that inspired activism and reflection. And she didn't apologize for who she was, because she knew there was nothing to apologize for. I mean, in 2012, the General Convention of the Episcopal Church voted to make her a saint. Imagine that. So, as you can probably tell, I'm really glad Kim suggested I look into the life of Polly Murray. And I now fully understand why Kim is so inspired by her and her work. But of course, let's talk to Kim and hear about what she's doing today that is so reminiscent of Reverend Dr. Polly Murray.
So my name is Kim Jackson, and I am the senator-elect for District 41 in Georgia. And vocationally, I am actually an Episcopal priest, and I serve a congregation of people who are experiencing homelessness.
So you touched on this in your introduction, but career-wise, what was your path before you decided to run for Georgia Senate?
Yeah, so I have actually wanted to run for office for a long time. And so I feel like I've been building these paths simultaneously. But for the last 10 years, I've served as an Episcopal priest in a number of different kinds of ways, but always with a focus towards social justice and working in particular with marginalized communities. So this is so much in line, I think, with a lot of the work that I've done. I've very much felt like my faith compelled me to speak out in the public square. And so this Senate race was built on that foundation.
Right. And so what was that beginning impulse that made you want to run in the first place?
Yeah, so I had the light bulb moment, excuse me, when I was 13 years old. Wow. I mean, I feel like I am exactly what teachers like really want to happen. in that, you know, I'm the little like nerdy kid that they put in a program and they expose me to various different kinds of public service events. So we went and saw firefighters and police officers and all kinds of different things. But we ended the night at a city council meeting, and I saw the first Black mayor of my city, which is a majority white city, governing. And I had that light bulb moment where I said, oh, wow, this is how you make a real difference in the world. And I knew at 13 that I felt called to make a real difference in the world. And so I was seeing elected office as a way to do that. And so I've really kind of had it on my mind ever since.
Wow, that's incredible. That's so, yeah, that is a teacher's dream. Like, here's the example and take it and run with it. And you did. That's so great. So then my next question is, What was it like to run a campaign? Because I see all of these images of people, out and about and like making speeches and doing all this stuff. And like, I have no idea what that must be like in reality.
Yeah. So, we can talk pre-pandemic and then post-pandemic running for office, right? So I started running, 7 months before the pandemic. And it was a lot of, making speeches, but not like with big crowds. I was running a simple state race for state senate. And so it was a lot of being in people's living rooms with, bunches of people and learning how to like strategically hold a cup in my hand that looked like I didn't need it ever refilled while I talked to people about the issues that matter to them. And, it's funny, I learned, so as a pastor, as a preacher, I preach sermons I preach a sermon every week. And I learned, when you're running a campaign, you actually do a stump speech and you do that stump speech every time. It doesn't really change very much. Mm-hmm. And I had this kind of light bulb moment of like, oh, I wonder how much better my sermons would be if I got to say them and do them like 5, 6, 20, 25 times, right? Like practice does indeed make perfect. And so it's a fascinating kind of work to kind of go around an entire district and even beyond, because you have to raise a lot of money. And so, I did events outside of my district to raise money. And sometimes I tell people it felt like I was always getting ready for a pop quiz. Because after I would do my stump speech, we'd open it up for questions and people would ask me questions like from things about healthcare to coal ash in water to obscure questions about tax law. I mean, it was very, very fascinating to see the things that people cared about. And I always felt like I just needed to be prepared for whatever they threw my way and also be okay and willing to say, I don't know about that, but let me get back to you about it. So that was pre-pandemic, a lot of house parties, a lot of small groups. And then post-pandemic, once we were in the pandemic, it was a lot of Zoom conversations, very much like this, right? And in the first 2 or 3 months of the pandemic, it was also a lot of like helping people figure out the technology of Zoom, because it was a lot of older people who, and honestly, even some of us who were not old had been using Zoom, right?
So, yeah.
It was a lot of like troubleshooting. And I feel like, we'd set up a house party, there'll be like 45 minutes. And the first 15 of them alone would just be like saying, can you hear me? Can you hear me? it was different. But different in a good way. I think it gave me an opportunity, I think actually to meet more people, because I didn't have to go to all the different places. People could, sit in the comfort of their home and show up. And so there were some real, real gifts that came out of that.
Mm. And then of course you won. Congratulations, of course.
Thank you.
So how did that feel to have this a victory of something that is a new pursuit for you? I mean, you've known you've wanted to do it for a while, but this was the first real go at it. And B, having such a historic win.
Yeah. I won my primary back in June, and it was a four-way race, and we ran without a runoff. And so that was the big win for me. I think like that the night before the election, like I couldn't sleep. I was super anxious. And, when the numbers finally came in, and it took 8 days for that to happen. I think in some ways it's both like an enormous amount of jubilation and an extraordinary amount of like relief and just a sigh that this thing that I worked on so hard was that point was finished at the end of the primary. And so it was a really mixed place of like, I'm exhausted and super excited and I'm super grateful and full of great joy. And then, for this November win, we'd had some really good statistics on our side. And so I think some of the surprise and the anxiety that I had in the primary wasn't there in the same way. But what has been more surprising is, yes, I knew that this was a historic race, but I don't think I knew what that meant for the larger world, right? Like, I never expected on election night to see like this, all of this outpouring of congratulations from like literally around the world. I didn't anticipate it. I didn't know what to do with it. I felt like I'm glad people can see me because I think I was just like constantly blushing at the attention.
Right.
It's just, you know, and I mean, nothing about my life changed on election night, right? Mm. Except everything about my life changed. Mm. And so it's just this very strange juxtaposition to be in. And the last thing I'll say about my win, and particularly the historic nature of it, is, you know, I spent the vast majority of my 20s in a place where my sexual orientation was a source of great pain for my family and a real like struggle point in my life. And so it's the juxtaposition of going from my 20s, where my sexual orientation was a source of shame, to being in my 30s, where my sexual orientation is being celebrated and lauded around the nation, is astounding. And I wish that I could go back and tell my 20-year-old self, like, it's going to be okay.
Right.
You got to wait, you know, got to wait a little while, but it's going to be okay. This will be celebrated. Because that has, I think in many ways, that's been really redeeming for so much pain that I experienced in my younger years.
That's beautiful. That's incredible. That's such a wonderful place to be. Finally, I know, of course, like it could have been earlier in every situation, but that is a wonderful place to get to finally. So then how would you say your identity helps you succeed?
So I mean, I'm African-American. Mm-hmm. I am a lesbian. I am a woman. So, and I'm in the South. So I have a number of intersectional identities that I think have made me much more resilient and much clearer about, if I want to do something, if I feel called to do something, then I gotta like put on all of like the armor that I have. And like, I have learned how to fight, right? I think because I was a Black girl growing up in South Carolina, mm-hmm. In a place that didn't necessarily love little Black girls, right? I have learned how to fight for the things that I feel called to, the things that I feel drawn to. And so I think that's been really important. And the other piece to it is that because I, you know, sit at the intersections of so many different marginalized communities, when I meet other people, so in my district, we have a substantial community of refugees who've been resettled here in our district. And so when they meet me, because they know about the intersections, they know that I know something of struggle, right? While we cannot connect over, like, I have never known war, they get that I do know, however, discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some connection points. And I think that so many people who exist in intersections of communities that have been marginalized, there's a certain amount of trust that we share with each other because they see me and they get it. And, you know, and even it's funny, when I was campaigning and actually going places, you know, I'd have, you know, straight white women who would come up to me and they'd bring their children with me. And they just like, I just want my kid to meet you because my kid is queer and I want them to see what is possible. Right. And so those intersections, I think, have been really important. Representation does matter, but it matters because it helps people, I think, dream a new dream and to imagine something possible that for so long hasn't seemed possible.
Right. Absolutely. So you are now in this position where you're a role model for children, for me, for, you know, like for people who have been able to see you succeed. But who would you say are the people that you've looked up to in this journey and in life in general?
Yeah, so I mean, the first person that comes to mind, her name is Simone Bell. She was the first African American legislator in the entire nation ever elected. And she happened to be elected here in Georgia. She was one of the first calls that I made when I was deciding if I wanted to run. I trusted that Simone would tell me if I had the fortitude for it, right? If I could do it. And that example, I remember, so Simone was elected 10 years ago. And so I was in my mid-20s, newly out. And there was this Black lesbian who rode motorcycles, riding up to the Capitol. And I just remember being so inspired by that and feeling so much hope that this dream that I'd had since I was 13, that maybe it hadn't been ruined because of my sexual orientation, right? So Simone is one of those. And then certainly, I feel like I stand on the shoulders of so many Black women who have come before me. And, I lift up Shirley Chisholm and Barbara Jordan and so many others. And as a clergy person, one of the pivotal moments for me and realizing that I could do this was actually the late Reverend Clemente Pinckney, who was the pastor of the AME church that was killed in Charleston.
Right.
I don't know how many people were aware, but he was also a senator. And so when they honored the Charleston Nine and they talked about this Reverend Senator Clemente Pinckney, it reminded me, and I think really cemented for me, that my vocation as a clergy person could in fact line up with a calling to run for office, right? Like, he was the embodiment of that for me. And so I'm very grateful for, his willingness and the life that he led in order to integrate those two callings, because it helped reaffirm for me that I could do that too.
Wow. Yeah, those are all incredible people to be looking up to. So I have one last question, and I like to ask people this because the podcast it focuses on Black women from the past and the present, so that we can then imagine a fuller and bigger future, for Black women. So what are you looking forward to in your new position, in your career, in the world of politics? What are your hopes for the future right now?
Oh, wow. I hope for a future where little Black kids, and I've worked with kids for a very long time, where the quality of their education is no longer dictated by the color of their skin and especially by the zip code in which they live, right? I dream a world in which Black and brown children receive quality education alongside their white peers. And I dream of a future where this, my election isn't unique, like where it's not, where it's just normal that that a certain population, that queer people, that Black women, that we have elected office, and that's normal and it's expected, and that I'm not the only one, right? I do dream of a world where, and I dream of a Senate in Georgia where I'm not the only out person serving. And I dream of a future where being a Black woman is not just celebrated by us. I think that we as Black women have done a lot of work to love ourselves, and we know how strong we are. We know how resilient we are. We know how awesome we are. And I dream of a world where other people see that too, right? Where other people recognize that we come with an immense amount of gifts to share with the world, and that those things should be celebrated. And not just tolerate it, right? Mm. And I think finally, I dream of a world where little Black girls growing up in the South, in a place like Calpin, South Carolina, where I'm from, where they can grow up free to be whoever they are. If they're little queer girls, that's cool. If they're just little smart, nerdy girls who like math, that's good, and that they can be in the math class and not be the only little Black girl there, right? Mm-hmm. I dream of a world where we get to be free. And my hope is that I get to be a part of creating that world. That's why I ran for office, is to help live into that. And so that's the world that I'm trying to cultivate and make. And I'm grateful for those who've come before me, who've helped move us closer and closer in that direction.
Wow, I'm so glad that I got to connect with Kim. It's wonderful to hear her story. I'm really excited to see how she fares in the state Senate and beyond. And since we're talking about Georgia, let's talk about how the election season is definitely not over down there. If you are a Georgia voter, I'm sure this is not your first reminder, but I would feel strange if I didn't say that you can request your mail-in ballot right now for the runoff election that is taking place on the 5th of January. This election is going to determine two senator races that are very important because they will determine whether the Senate is majority Republican or Democrat. So, if you can vote in the election, I think it's a pretty important one to vote in. Just like we all made voting plans in November, it's just as important to make voting plans for every single election that you can participate in. I'm going to leave voting information for those races in the description of this episode. This week, I am left thinking about what it means to be an active participant. It can feel scary, daunting, or even pointless sometimes to use your voice to try and make a difference, but boy, is it important to try. I'm reminded this is true by the barriers that Polly Murray absolutely shattered. Not only was she able to make life more livable for countless folks, but she continues to serve as a role model for changemakers of today to look up to. We have a clear example of this through Kim Jackson. I'm so excited to see what Kim will be able to do for her community and beyond. I imagine that having someone to look up to like Polly can only bolster Kim in her pursuits. And luckily, it doesn't stop there. Now Kim can serve as a role model to those who come up under her as well. So, as much as the phrase, history repeats itself, is used to recognize how difficult it is to avoid atrocities from the past, this week, I'm thinking of that phrase a little differently. I'm encouraged by the stories of Polly and Kim to see that the history of Black women breaking barriers and moving things forward repeats itself too. And that is not something I will ever take for granted. Thank you so much for listening. I used the following sources to research this week's episode. Polly Murray Center for History and Social Justice. National Organization for Women. The Many Lives of Polly Murray by Catherine Schultz from The New Yorker. National Museum of African American History and Culture's article on Polly Murray. Forbes' article, Meet the Forgotten Woman Who Forever Changed the Lives of LGBTQ+ Workers by Leah Rosenbaum and Breanne Garrett. And Poetry Foundation's article on Polly Murray. Special thanks to Kim Jackson and original music, as always, by Adam Westerman.